brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
You're listening to CHM Live Radio. I'm Chanel Lauren, and I produce the museum's live speaker series. Each year, we bring incredible guests to the museum to talk about computing and the transformational effects it's having on our society. We've hosted a wide range of speakers, from geneticists and asteroid miners.
I am worried about sustainability if we don't draw resources from space.
To technology giants like Elon Musk and Sheryl Sandberg.
Not everyone can join the high-tech rocket ship industry, but there are areas of every company, of every industry, where your skills are more important and there's a growing need for them.
Could space be the next place we turn for natural resources? Near-Earth asteroids are packed with valuable minerals and resources that can be incredibly useful for space travel and colonization. Teams of engineers and scientists are already working on ways to mine these materials using technologies we already use every day. In this episode, we'll hear from Chris Lewicki, the CEO of asteroid mining company Planetary Resources.
We're leveraging a lot of the mobile computing, cloud computing, the autonomy that we're having, and even the things that we're getting into localized AI in terms of algorithms. All these things, the same thing that's going to enable autonomous cars from a sensor network is the same thing that's going to enable autonomous navigation around an asteroid.
So, how does asteroid mining work? What types of resources do asteroids have that people on Earth need? And how could it enable further space exploration? What technological advancements are needed to make asteroid mining a successful commercial business? Find out in this conversation between Chris Lewicki and former museum CEO John Holler. It was recorded in March of 2017.
We have a lot to talk about because you guys are doing such interesting work. Let's talk first about you personally. Tell us a little bit about your background. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in northern Wisconsin in dairy country. You can probably still hear twinges of my Wisconsin accent. I was a space nut probably, since Carl Sagan was on TV and I was able to look up and see the night sky and, set a career on it relatively early.
Were you ever inspired by a teacher? Did you ever have a teacher who got you going on something and you thought, wow, engineering or math or science is really important?
I think I got probably a lot of help. I remember a fourth grade teacher, Mr. Cornelius, who the reward for finishing your work early was you got to play chess. So that was a motivation when astronomy was something that I realized was a profession. And I think that probably continued into high school with two different science teachers, a biology teacher, Mr. Maddie, and a physics teacher, Mr. Baumgartner, who essentially, after I had gotten through, the basic coursework and was waiting around, they let me kind of invent my own plan. So I got to do things like make Tesla coils and Jacob's ladders and things like that, which probably the school board should have never known about. but I didn't do it on premises. So. I think they helped out a lot, and it was just realizing that not everything that is defined is what you're limited to.
I've asked that question of a lot of people, and almost always you can remember the name of that teacher. It's really incredible how vivid the memories can be sometimes. So you eventually made your way to NASA. Now, how did that happen for you?
I actually realized that was my path in life probably in eighth grade, and it was during a time when we were still exploring the solar system and seeing things for the very first time. There was a mission launched just a few years after I was born, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, that were sent to explore Jupiter and Saturn, and then they had a mission which extended out to see Uranus and then Neptune. And I remember in eighth grade watching, probably in the newspapers at the time, or maybe on the evening news, flying by the planet Neptune, and it was this blue dot that was out there on the edge of the solar system. This was before the Hubble Space Telescope, so it was like the biggest telescope on the largest mountain on the planet could see it as like 2 pixels. And then one day, all at once, it was a place. And there were clouds and there were moons and there was a storm and you could start to, it was something where I realized, I want to do that. Mm. And that's when I learned what aerospace engineering was. I didn't realize how closely it was to mechanical engineering. There was no university in the state of Wisconsin that offered a degree in aerospace engineering, so I had to leave the state. Ended up at the University of Arizona, which, as it turns out, is at the center of planetary exploration. They've been involved in pretty much every mission to every planet every time, and actually participated in some NASA missions while I was still a student.
And then went from there to NASA? Did you make the jump directly from?
Just about directly. There was an internet startup in there. Actually, an internet startup with my co-founders at Planetary Resources, which is a piece of our history as well. I came in. I worked on a comet mission. Worked on an asteroid rover, both of which are canceled, which is the norm. When you see these missions on the news, just remember that there were like 9 that were killed, so that one could live. So I experienced that side of things. And then ultimately got involved in the Mars Rovers projects, and the rest is history.
How did you get the asteroid named for you?
University of Arizona is one of the first places, or actually not one of, the first place, to systematically survey asteroids. In a program called Spacewatch, which realized that we need to start monitoring these things. And I had some friends as a student who worked at Spacewatch, and if you discover asteroids, it turns out you have the honor of getting to name them, and he had an abundance of discovered asteroids and happened to get one. But it wasn't until 2004, actually, when I was working on the Mars rovers, that he got the opportunity to actually pen it in. So I was already well into my career at NASA when he nominated me for having 13609 named after me.
Now, I think you may be the first person we've ever interviewed here or taken the oral history of, or many other things that we do, who went from NASA to do a startup. And that's such an interesting career path. So can you talk a little bit about why you did that and what you were hoping to do?
Well, there are two reasons, I think, that I made that decision. One, it was something my co-founders, Peter Diamandis, who is a co-founder of Singularity University here in the Bay Area at NASA Ames, and then Eric Anderson, who is behind every private citizen who's gone into space that you've read about on the news. Eric made that happen. And I knew both of them for pretty much all of my adult life. And they reached out and asked me if I would like to help them start this company. And I realized they weren't going to give up. One was, kind of a decision based on a Mark Twain quote: "In life, you don't regret the things you do; you regret the things that you don't." That was really what closed my decision. Kind of what opened my mind up to it was participated in landing 3 different things on Mars. That was enough for me. And I wanted to try that out. And I thought I had something to contribute. And, what good is experience and a reputation if you aren't willing to put it on the line?
Spoken like a true entrepreneur, I think. So
time will tell.
Let's talk a little bit about Planetary Resources. I read a quote where you said, "People think about asteroid mining as going deep into space, mining and bringing the materials back to Earth. But our business model is to be the lead in building space infrastructure." So we do think about mining as bringing things back to Earth, and you're describing something completely different. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mining is really the best word that we have for it right now, but we'll invent a new word at some point. We're aiming to be the leading resource provider for people and products in space, and really the most important thing in people in space is going to be people. And people need things, and stuff comes from somewhere. Like the opening video said, if you had to bring everything with you, imagine going on vacation and having to pack your hotel. That would be maybe a bit more like camping. The way that we actually build economies and develop businesses and raise families and play and work is by settling down and using, at first, local resources, and then trading and building that out. And it turns out in that the way that physics works in gravity, that the near-Earth asteroids are the most accessible nearby thing that we can make things out of, that we can use outside of orbiting the Earth.
So what you're solving for is not having to take it all with you the moment you leave the Earth.
Absolutely. We want to send the complicated, irreplaceable things and get the basic stuff on site. You know, things like water, which is actually the very first thing that we'll develop. Water is a pretty simple molecule. It's, of course, very important in our biology. It's very important in our daily lives, hygiene and manufacturing and even chemical processes. But in space, it actually takes on two kind of non-obvious roles. One is that you hear about radiation in space, cosmic rays that can pass through anything, can damage your cells and develop cancers and things like that. So outside of Earth orbit, you have to protect yourself from that or suffer the risk. Water can protect you from that radiation, but you need tons and tons and tons of it. 50 tons of water to give you a nice bubble to protect you from radiation, it will cost $500 million to send into space. It's kind of expensive to do that. The other thing is also recognizing that molecule of water is made of hydrogen and oxygen. And hydrogen and oxygen are the things that we've used in the space shuttle. It's actually what Jeff Bezos' company Blue Origin uses in their BE3 and BE4 engines that they're developing. And it's the most efficient rocket propellant that there is that you can burn and produce high thrust with. And in the same way that Rockefeller made a lot of money and changed the 20th century with supplying this energy source into a transportation market, water is that element, that stuff, that's going to do that in the 21st century in space.
And what is it about the asteroid that makes that abundance so available to a company that's doing mining, as you said, since it's the best word that we have to apply to it?
Well, water is, of course, abundant on Earth, but as I described, it's really expensive to ship it. We do this on Earth anyway, to get your spring-fed water and things like that. But to send it into space is really expensive. But as it turns out, asteroids are these objects left over from the formation of the solar system. One of the pieces is an iron meteorite, a lot of metal on it, and of course make things from that iron. But the other piece, which is maybe less interesting but much more important, is in this little acrylic block, and that's a carbonaceous chondrite meteorite. It's a lot like a comet. Half of all the asteroids in the solar system are that type of material, and many of them are very rich in water. And a lot of theories of the development of Earth kind of provide that this is maybe where the water on Earth came from. It's where the water on Enceladus came from. It's where the water on Pluto came from. So it's actually pretty abundant in the solar system, even in the poles of the moon. So we can, in the same way that we cut down trees and built log cabins and structures and bridges in settling the American West, we'll do that same thing with water on asteroids as we develop space.
I want to talk a little bit more about the positioning of Earth and asteroids and the way that the actual exploration part of your business works in a minute, but let's talk about the company itself. So when you first were going out and talking about this, and you obviously had two additional people who were crazy enthusiastic about this, was it hard when you said to people, we're starting an asteroid mining company? How many pitches did you get laughed out of, or were people really getting it quickly?
Well, it wasn't a seed stage VC pitch, certainly,
right.
When we started off. But part of what made it happen is the combination of my experience kind of coming from the NASA world and understanding the technical details of what it takes to start this project. It's the experience of my co-founders in starting things that also were equally improbable. Burt Rutan's company that won the Ansari X Prize that is now Virgin Galactic, and making a business out of sending private citizens into outer space, both of those things shouldn't have happened. But kind of the combination of experience and know-how and network, and also, as we started this about 8 years ago now, was the internet was coming of age and kind of quite mature by that time. And we were realizing that technology was really redefining the rate of progress in general. You know, anything that you could put on the curve of Moore's law was accelerating, and space was starting to become part of that. So we could connect the dots and say that, you know, this is something that's not going to be in your grandchildren's lifetime. This is definitely going to be in your lifetime. And not only that, it may be the biggest business opportunity yet. Mm. You know, it's the only business which it doesn't have the sky as a limit. It scales, you know, more than the carrying capacity of the Earth. So, you know, if we worry about 7 billion humans, the only way we're going to get, you know, any future in millions of people living in space, billions of people living and working and playing in space, is to allow them to live there. So it was, you know, folks like Larry Page and Richard Branson, Charles Simony, Ross Perot Jr. and others that kind of made an outside bet on, you know, maybe this isn't that crazy. Mm. And they let us get a start on it. And from a startup standpoint, we're just like any other startup, you know, except we had maybe a more complicated and long-term business model. But the steps to get from here to there, for me, are still very clear. And in many ways, we're not even an aerospace company or a space company. We're a resource company. We model ourselves after the energy industry and the mineral industry, and they have timelines that last 10, 20, 30 years. They have funding levels which take billions of dollars for a project. And in many cases, they have to invent new technology for what they're doing, but they do it because what they are providing is essential. And of course, the price only goes up. So this is merely this place in history. And I actually like being here today in the Computer History Museum because it's not like computers are over. we're still in an environment where that art continues. And space is also something that is not the future anymore. It's the present. And this is something that we're past the government age and science age of space. We're in now to the industrialization of space. And it's not something that's a few years out. We're a couple years into it already.
Let's talk about the technology for a minute. What do you have to build yourself versus what you can rely on other people to supply to the business?
So we're creating the technologies that kind of bridge that gap of going deeper into outer space, out to an asteroid a few million miles away. And we're leveraging a lot of the mobile computing, cloud computing, the autonomy that we're having, and even you know, the things that we're getting into localized AI in terms of algorithms. All these things, the same thing that's going to enable autonomous cars from a sensor network is the same thing that's going to enable autonomous navigation around an asteroid. It's the same technology, just a different physics model. So these are the things that we're developing today, and we think we can actually bring that price down by at least two orders of magnitude on the first go around, in the same way that, you know, everyone has a supercomputer in their pocket now and we don't think much of it. But this is what technology and even tools have provided, and that it doesn't take 1,000 people to do these things anymore. We can do them with less than 100 people, or in some cases, just a dozen or two. So those are all the things that make this kind of audacious sounding topic much more approachable because of just everything that is happening around it.
The structure of what we know is the video we watched earlier used it, the part of our planetary system that's near to the Earth and the part that's far out and the asteroid belt in between. I don't know that is necessarily well known by anyone, and to understand where you're going and where these asteroids are and the physics and the telemetry to try to get there. Can you talk a little bit about what's between us and the asteroids and then on the other side of the asteroid belt? I think that's really interesting because it's essential to the business.
So, you know, to quote my co-founder, Peter, as humans, we're evolved to think local and linear. And we measure how long it takes to get somewhere by time and distance. And when you look in space, time and distance end up being literally astronomical numbers. And it's kind of hard for us to comprehend going to something that's 100 million miles away. And we've got one illustration we can bring up here to kind of show this point. So when you think about distance in space, we've got all of us in our comfortable lives here on the surface of the planet. We have low Earth orbit there where the International Space Station is. We have high Earth or geosynchronous orbit where the weather satellites and communication satellites and those things are. And then there's an enormous distance. And we get out to some special gravitational spots, the moon, asteroids and Mars and Pluto and the rest of the universe out there. And it seems really, really far away. But as it turns out, that's not how you actually have to, as an engineer, work with space travel. In space travel, you work with energy. And it's about how much energy, how much gas in the tank do I need to do to meet up with this spot in space. And if we look at space in terms of energy, and we can transition to the next part of the chart here, what you realize is that once you get into space, you're close to everything from an energy standpoint, and it's the Earth that's actually far away. And getting even to the International Space Station, even though it's a couple hundred miles up, is a Herculean task. It's rocket science. You know, we have jokes about it, but it is very, very, very difficult just to get that far. But as Robert Heinlein said, once you're into low Earth orbit, you're halfway to anywhere in the solar system. Because if you take the same amount of energy that it took you to get to the International Space Station, and you fill your spacecraft back up, you now go to Pluto. And this is the idea behind if we can get fuel in space and bring it to your spaceship and top it off, you know, the solar
system. Oh, the places you'll go.
Oh, the places you go. The solar system is your oyster. And there's an analogy you can think about this, and this is layman's rocket science. You see, I don't know, like a car chase scene, maybe The Matrix or something like that. And you've got these people jumping between cars, and either the cars are right in front of each other or they're riding down parallel lanes, and the hero can jump between those two cars pretty easily. And then there's imagine what it would be like if you had, you know, the 680 and the 280, and you're trying to jump into a car that's on the 680 and into another one that's going at 280. That would be much harder. But that's actually what it takes to, like, go to Mars or go to Jupiter or go to Pluto. That's a huge leap. It takes an extraordinary amount of energy, really powerful legs to do that. But to get to the asteroids is kind of like just jumping across the lane. So this is the opportunity that we have with the near-Earth asteroids. It's even easier than getting to the surface of the moon. The moon's there, it's really close. A dozen people have walked around down the place. And that makes it all the more extraordinary that we were able to do that. But this is why the asteroids are really a special place, and it's kind of the beachfront in the new real estate that we're gonna be developing and hopefully setting up homes and businesses on.
Is that a question that you got? Why not just go to the moon and do this mining and not take the time to go all the way?
It's a question I get every day. Yeah. And it's because, in 1969, we grabbed the future and ripped it into the present and did that extraordinary thing, and it just makes you realize how amazing it was. Asteroids at that time weren't something that we really even knew much about. They were points of light that went through the sky. We didn't have a picture of any of them. We certainly didn't have a good idea of how many were out there. But you know, it's only been one generation since we've had a picture of an asteroid. That happened in the 1990s, and just in the past 15 years, we've discovered 95% of the asteroids that are currently known. So it's exponential discovery that's happening. And it's something that we just didn't even realize that was just waiting at our doorstep.
Talk about now the vision for how you pick an asteroid out, how you select it, how you know what you're looking for on the asteroid, the process of landing on it, if you will, the process of mining it. What does all that look like in your business model?
Yeah, so it follows a very similar model to finding a mine. You want something that's got a lot of what you're looking for. You want it to have good accessibility. You want...
What does it mean to have good accessibility?
You can get to it. You think of like ice road truckers. As an example, you know, you can only get out of those places in the summer when everything thaws.
Yeah.
So that's not great accessibility. That's why we, you know, started mining in more temperate places. So because of the scarcity of resources on Earth, we're going to more and more challenging places to get resources. But the asteroids were actually low-hanging, easy pickings now. So those are really, you know, the prime drivers. And even though there's a lot of these things out there and we have pieces of them, we don't know exactly like what's the easiest, best place to start. Mm. And that's the goal of our next set of missions, is to send a robotic geologist out to several near-Earth asteroids, confirm that what we're looking for in water is there, confirm that it's at a rich enough grade, and then with that information, we can start to then do the experiments and do the development that it will take to make a mine. And you know, the next question you're probably going to ask is, well, how do you mine an asteroid? And the thing, you know, and the short answer is we don't really know. You know, that's kind of a, you know, just a short joke about it. The real thing is it's going to happen in a way that is different than what you do on Earth. On Earth, you have to take into account, you know, how much things weigh. You have to take into account diesel and labor and environmental regulations. You have to worry about kind of populations in the area, and ore grades and tectonics and aqueous processes. You don't have any of those problems. And, you know, the cost of electricity, how much steel costs today, those all factor into making your mine on Earth. But in space, you know, energy is free. You've got the sun, 24 hours a day, no weather, no night-day cycles. So you can get megawatts or gigawatts of thermal energy. You've got a perfect vacuum. That would, you know, you would pay dearly for to create in space. So you can extract things and evaporate them and kind of distill the asteroid, mm-hmm. bake the water out of it with that energy. And then we pay dearly for refrigeration. And refrigeration is one of the great innovations in the last few centuries. But in space, you know, if it's not really hot right next to the sun, everything else is really, really cold. So that 3 degree Kelvin is surrounding you, and it's available for free, and you can cool that water that you just baked off into the asteroid into an ice cube. So you're actually harnessing three different pieces of abundance in thermodynamics to mine, so to speak. So maybe this is distilling and ice cube forming or
it's
something.
It's industrial. For sure.
Or maybe it's like they said in Star Wars, what it might have had it right, it's moisture farming. So it's really different technologies, and it's all things that are relatively simple that we actually can use a lot of technologies that have been demonstrated in space for decades to begin.
And this is all done autonomously.
Yes. No astronauts will be necessary. Sorry to disappoint people who are thinking about this future career. But, and again, the same reason why we're not going to need people to drive our cars very soon. And the same reason why we have surgical robots that can help a surgeon be telepresent, we can use those technologies to put robots in, you know, a dangerous, non-supporting, life-supporting environment, and, you know, do this thankless work on a barren rock orbiting the sun.
I want to talk about who's on the other side of this equation and who might be excited about the prospect that you're going to do this pretty amazing work. First of all, let's talk about NASA. Is NASA now looking, since we are apparently looking at trying to do something manned to Mars at some point in the future, is NASA excited about the prospect of being able to refuel or resource up in space?
Yeah, you're laying it out. It's in their required technology roadmap. For us to figure these things out. It's something, a very technical term called in-situ resource utilization, a wonderful acronym, ISRU, NASA being famous for acronyms and complexity. And you know, this is essentially using things locally and coming up with a process to extract it. You know, to be able to have people live on Mars, you need to be able to, you know, create a breathable environment out of the atmosphere. You need to be able to get water out of the soil. You need to be able to create methane to have a rocket fuel source from the surface so you can launch back off the planet you can get that out of the atmosphere. So that's something it's very important to NASA. And also in the intro, you talked about, you know, potentially a $1 trillion market. Space today is already, you know, a $300 to $400 billion global market across transportation, not only rockets, but things like GPS, weather satellites, imaging, communication satellites, you know, research and development. And like anything that gets industrialized, the same way that computers created a medium to change commerce, space is going to become the medium for a new form of business. So going from a few $100 billion market into maybe a few dozen $1 trillion market in the next 100 years, I don't think is something that is beyond the imagination if we just look backwards 100 years and how all these technologies have just really changed our relationship with the planet. So there are companies today, whether it's SpaceX or Blue Origin, that are demonstrating reusable technologies for their spacecraft. SpaceX has talked about being able to refuel their vehicles on the way to Mars. We're talking about habitats on the surface of the moon, which are going to need supplies both with fuel to get there to and from and materials to build things from. And I think we're going to actually see a redefinition of how we get to places. And it's kind of a redefinition of when we went from horses to cars to buses to whatever it is now, human drones. Or a redefinition of how cargo transport works, where we went from rail to port cities and now things like the Hyperloop. We're going to see essentially maybe the hub and spoke model start to develop in space, where all of the launch vehicle companies will do what they can do best, which is get us to the edge of space, get us to the doorstep, and then reuse that technology and get us there again. And what we'll see now is instead of delivering that package all the way from point A to B with one thing, you'll have a different courier that picks it up at the local hub and then takes it to its final destination. Mm. And that courier will be refueled from material that we get into space. And this is the way that it needs to be. And it's going to follow the same pattern that we've seen in all of our transportation and all of our package delivery systems, for that matter.
Will there be, in that very vivid picture of how this is all going to work, will there be another layer of some sort of space vehicle out there that's going to be the Gulf oil station, Rockefeller's day?
We'll probably see a few different things. We'll see something that NASA first introduced, an idea called fuel depots, the Shell and Gulf Oil and BP stations for doing that. They'll have oxygen, they'll have hydrogen, and the other things that'll be kind of useful from a liquid propellant standpoint. We'll have what you could think of as a tug or a freighter, kind of the long haul trucking things, where things that just kind of go back and forth between two points that refuel themselves at these fuel depots. But we'll also have other destinations. We will have research facilities. We'll have manufacturing facilities. We will have way stations, a place where you go from low Earth orbit to high Earth orbit, and then you go from there on your way to the moon or Mars or a space colony that's just out in free space. Mm. This is all stuff that's exciting because it's out of the mind of science fiction, but that science fiction was written by authors who understood physics and understood really the reality that all these things needed to live in. And today, we have the technology, and the cost of that technology has kind of gotten to the point of being affordable from an investment standpoint that we can start to deploy it privately.
I was surprised to learn in doing research for tonight that in 2015, President Obama signed a law that recognizes the right for U.S. citizens to own the asteroid resources they discover. What was behind that?
Well, it was out of an ambiguity that in 1967, when we were in the height of the space race, there was a concern by all the members of the United Nations to not have a red moon or a red, white, and blue moon. We wanted to make sure, the countries wanted to make sure that we just didn't go and appropriate, all these places and claim them as kind of the part of the superpowers. So what they said at that time was that you couldn't make a territory, mm. Out of the moon, as an example. And what that created was a challenge, if you don't have a territory, you can't own property. They didn't say that you couldn't do business in space and that you couldn't go out and pick things up. NASA has done that several times, and the Soviet Union has done it well. Some of these materials have been sold at auction. So there are private citizens who own stuff that's been brought back from space. What the United States did, under the leadership of a number of congressmen and senators, was recognized as that we need to put in a framework around this ambiguous point in history and recognize that if you go out into space and you pick something up, you know, kind of like picking up a rock off the beach, no one owned that rock before you were there, but you picked it up, okay, you can have that one. You know, it's now your property. And we might think about it similar to getting a fishing license. Getting a fishing license doesn't entitle you to own any particular fish, but if you go out there and you invest and you go in the ocean and you capture that fish is now your property according to that license. So that law kind of filled in that ambiguity, and that allowed really for a number of things to fall into place very quickly thereafter. Last year, we saw the government of Luxembourg, a small country in Europe that is probably most famous for how small it is, a very visionary and agile startup-like country, in that they see an opportunity and an agile group that's able to pivot and go after something. They actually did this 30 years ago when their steel industry was in decline and their media industry was kind of rising, but was limited by how much they could hit with a broadcast tower within the citizens of Luxembourg who were nearby, who is not many citizens. What they realized, though, is if you put that broadcast tower on top of a really big tower in space, you could broadcast to all of Europe. And no one had done that before commercially, but they invested in a company and they helped create a framework, and they advocated for policy globally that supported that. And what we have today is one of the largest operators of geostationary satellites in the world, SES, a Luxembourg company, still owned in part by the government, that led the way for that and created that environment within Luxembourg. And the Prime Minister Xavier Bettel and Deputy Prime Minister Etienne Schneider last year announced an initiative to be that catalyst for space resources and created a $250 million initiative to set up an environment in Luxembourg to do that. And not only did they do that, they made an investment in our company, joined our board of directors, and are passing their own laws to help further define this. So it's something where any new technology, any new business concept is in a little bit of a co-development with the regulatory and legal framework that surrounds it.
The boundaries have to be figured out.
Yeah, and the business, the technology, and the law kind of all march together forward, and they are all moving forward now in topics like asteroid mining.
The Earth observation business, everything we've been talking about up to this point is looking out toward the asteroids. You're also looking back toward the Earth with some really breakthrough technology. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, part of our philosophy includes using Earth orbit as a proving grounds and as a testing place. And we've already launched a few satellites to test out technology, some of the different ways that we're doing computing and power management. And what we're doing this year is testing out a new sensor technology called midwave infrared. And this is something that we're particularly nuts about, because it's the very type of measurement you need to make to detect water on an asteroid. It's the way that astronomers do it today, but it's not something that's ever been commercially put into space, much less to look back down. And what we realized as we're launching the ARCID-6 satellites this
ARCID.
Year. Yeah, ARCID, a little bit of aside. This is the name that we had for the company when we were in stealth mode. And it happens to be drawn from the Star Wars universe of the manufacturer of the probe droids that were in the opening scene on the ice planet Hoth in The Empire Strikes Back, which before the Empire weaponized it, was a resource prospector in the asteroid belts around solar systems.
ARCID.
ARCID. So the ARCID-6 satellite has on it the first ever commercial midwave infrared sensor, which both can look for signatures of water, but also detect thermal signatures. And we realized while we're testing this thing out and pointing it down, we're collecting data that does not exist in the market. We can look at signs of production. We can look at agriculture from a moisture standpoint of, are my crops dry? We can look at plant activity, not in the actual act of photosynthesis, but we can kind of, we can see when you start to sweat, before you break a fever. And it's something where we could see some of these phenomenologies before other technologies that are out there could. So this is an active area where we look at you know, just like the space program has had many spin-offs that they didn't anticipate, part of our philosophy in developing our business is to look for opportunities that leverage the breakthroughs that we create. You know, this is something, the X-Labs, Astra Teller talks frequently about, you know, a 10x problem. And, you know, we're not solving a 5% or 10% incremental improvement. We're getting an order of magnitude to go out and figure out how to mine asteroids. And this is one of those really hard technologies that you wouldn't start with. But it really opens up new market opportunities for us that we're, you know, developing alongside what is really, you know, our guide star of resources in space.
Why is this technology so much more powerful than other imaging technologies that have previously been available?
Well, what we see with other imaging technologies is the same thing that we get with our eyeballs. And our eyes are, you know, wonderful things, but we can just see visible light. And the technology that we use to take computer pictures in visible light really doesn't even take color to the extent that we can see it. It captures red, green, and blue. So if you zoom into your computer monitor or you look at your CMOS sensor on your digital camera, all you're doing is collecting these three different bits of reflected light. And it doesn't tell you much. You know, I can take a picture of a car engine, and you know whether that car engine is running or not, you have no idea. It's gray. But if you take a thermal image of that car image, it's night and day. You know, not only do you know if it's running or not, but you know that it used to be running. And if the car drove away, you can see the warm spot that's left in the parking lot because that heat went somewhere else. So this is stuff that doesn't yet exist in the commercial market. And when you bring in things like hyperspectral imaging, which we're also using for looking at mineral signatures of things on asteroids, we can start to look at spectral fingerprints of things that we're measuring. So not only can I tell something is green, I can tell the difference between astroturf and real grass because they have a different way that they reflect all the different samples of light. So it's like ultra high def TV versus standard def TV. It's just a lot more information rich. And these are the things that we have to do in going out to an asteroid. We can't combine this with some other data set that we can scrape off the internet and then come up with the answer. You know, we have to create the data-rich answer, kind of from the start. So these are just some examples of technology that we're commercializing. We've got a number of other things infrastructurally that we've had to invent of turning a $1 billion mission, into a $1 million mission. And it's really the fun part of the innovation for me as an aerospace engineer is looking for opportunities to really jump the gap and bring these things that are just about ready to go into space and just to be able to push those things forward.
Who uses this imaging technology here on Earth? When you started showing this to people and they said, we've really got a need for that, can you give me an idea of the kinds of companies or the industries that need this kind of imaging and data?
Yeah, so I know one area that we talked about is in agriculture. Certainly understanding the largest industry that covers the surface of the Earth is actually agriculture. These are companies that have been using satellite data for decades, and this is the first significant innovation that's come in the data type in that amount of time. We also see things like the energy industry. If you were able to understand what was going on in an oil pipeline or an oil storage facility from a thermal signature instead of just taking a picture, those are data sets that we can create. But you can also think about it for the very same reasons that we're looking for things on an asteroid, from measuring an environmental aspect or looking at signatures and how the surface of the planet is changing. So it's something that, in many of these innovation, it starts in pure science. And the pure science solution is often really, really expensive, which is why only the government can afford it. Commercialization is about looking for those opportunities, combining them with the market, and then deploying it cost effectively, at a price the market will bear, and hopefully for a profit in a way that's scalable and repeatable.
By the way, you talked about not being able to scrape data off the internet because it just doesn't exist. How much asteroid data is out there? Because this is also new. Are you essentially inventing the data set as you go?
Well, generally speaking, there is a lot of information about asteroids. We've discovered over time 750,000 of them. There's believed to be about 60 million total. There have been many spacecraft now that have gone out and visited these places, orbited them, landed on them, in one case has even brought pieces back from them, and there's several more on the way. And with meteorites, you know, we have a lot of pieces of them right here on Earth. What we don't know is, we don't know about a particular asteroid. And we need to find, you know, the exact place that we're going to set up our first resource operation in space. So we can use the general knowledge that has been developed by the government exploration activity, but we can put it to specific application by doing our own research and development.
What needs to happen first? A Moon-Mars colony, regular supply missions, or the gas station in between?
The real trick is they all need to happen in parallel. You can't develop one entirely without the other. Without routine access to space available from commercial launch providers, you know, most innovative businesses you would see in space would not be possible. To be able to get all the way to Mars and develop infrastructure, we're probably going to need more resources than we can just launch into space. To develop a really thriving environment on the surface of the moon, we're going to include the resources of the asteroid. To allow businesses in space today and future new businesses, we're going to need to refuel and have transportation and communication infrastructure. And I think that's what's really exciting, is all of those things are happening right now. Mm. It's not just our company, it's not just the ones who are making the news. It's companies that you've never heard of who have been doing this for 30 years, who are actually, you know, taking their investments and putting their part into the future. So, you know, it was no one company that really made the personal computer popular. The survivors are the ones that we read about now. But the real innovation happened in hundreds, maybe thousands of companies. And that's what's happening in space today, is a number of people really trying to find that way to match the market and to move the whole thing forward.
How much of your business is based on or dependent upon technologies that don't even exist yet?
I very much feel, in my experience in working at NASA and what's available and what we have access today, everything that I'm talking about is technology that exists, if not in a laboratory, in some cases already orbiting the Earth. There are no laws of physics or equations that are unsolvable that we have to need to work through. It, with many things, is a confluence of a bunch of different things. And there's a great example recently that everyone is now experiencing personally, where, you know, we have cloud computing and the ability to turn around a query in lightning speed. We have portable devices that are connected through a network that's just about everywhere. We have the ability to record audio. We can take that audio and transcribe it into natural language. And then all of a sudden you have Siri and Cortana and Alexa. No one of those technologies invented that, and no one of those companies is responsible for all of that innovation. But the synthesis of all of them together is really what enabled that application and that connection to the market. And I feel that's where we are in space today. All of these technologies exist. It's about combining them in a way that kind of matches in a form factor and a cost with an application that solves a problem.
You said something earlier that I wanted to come back to about the reality of this new space age. Is that if you can just get what you need to get into space, into near Earth orbit, somebody's going to be there to take it the rest of the way. Doesn't that significantly lower the bar for anybody who wants to get something into near Earth orbit?
And it does.
What are the implications of that?
Think about how much the online world changed when you didn't need to buy a server, install the software, find a rack, buy the internet service, and you could just, like, go online and get that as a turnkey package and 3 minutes later, you know, be writing the code for your website. So this is what is happening right now in space. That act of getting to space, you don't need to build a rocket anymore. You know, you don't even need to buy the whole thing. Some of the most mundane innovations, the idea of putting shipments into standardized set of containers, whether it's container ships or, you know, the various sizes of FedEx packages or the US Postal Service, if it fits, it ships. Those we don't think of as innovations, but they allowed a very standard approach to delivery. And that's a model that I think exists in space, where we're able to get an ARCHID 6 satellite into space because if we make it a particular shape and has a particular way that it plugs into a rocket, we can get a very regular, very cheap launch on any rocket in the world. We don't have to design it for an exact rocket. Mm. So, you know, that's something that is in transition right now. And like you said, as this model changes over time, more and more of those things will just become infrastructure. And you won't need to solve that problem anymore because it's available as a service.
Anything that you can't get now in the way of technology or people or support that you wish you could get? Is there kind of a missing piece now that you think if that just falls into place, we're good?
Well, we've had, certainly from a technology standpoint, we've been making a lot of advances in dramatically reducing the cost of deploying things that can go to an asteroid. We've really found the right financial models, both taking from the mining and resource industries of how to finance these missions and doing it on a scale and a time scale that investors and businesses are familiar with. And as you mentioned, we've got the political progress that exists. I would say, you know, some of the specific things, something that people don't think exists but actually does, is there is a market for fuel in space today. And that market is currently being served by the third stage in every rocket that gets launched from the Earth. So you have to build a big rocket so you can fit that third stage on, so you can put your satellite on top of it and get it to where it's going. But if we can just get that, put the satellite under the second stage, get rid of the third stage, that function can be then taken care of by that space tug. So the demand is actually out there. It's being served by an expensive substitute at the moment. Some things that we're going to need to continue to innovate in is being able to communicate off across these vast distances in space. We've used radio technology to do this since the dawn of the space age, and we continue to. That takes these giant antennas and dishes that are operated by NASA that cost billions of dollars a year to operate. Even when I was flight director of the NASA missions, we didn't have like free use of them. You know, it's like the mission at Saturn needs the radio dish now. You have to, you know, hand it over. So for a private company to get access to that is something that we might be able to do once in a while, but we can't build a business on it. But here again, you know, the same technology that powers the fiber trunks that sends terabits per second of data down tubes of glass all around the planet. You know, we don't need the glass in space. The vacuum of space is a pretty good transmitter of photons. So, you know, in that case, developing some of those optical communications technologies and making them very low power and lightweight and small is one of the things that we're innovating in. And then, you know, the radiation problem is not a common problem. Another thing that we're developing a lot of IP to deal with, you know, your bit getting flipped from a zero to one when you don't want that to happen. So those are some new things that we've had to invent to be able to approach this commercially.
How much funding, conceptual support, technical support, do you need from NASA and the government as part of this whole enterprise?
You know, any large enterprise, of course, is going to intersect with the government in terms of providing services and filling a need that exists. And certainly we've drawn some support from NASA over the years. For the most part, it's been in research and development, innovation contracts, some of it supporting some of the missions that are related to asteroids. And that will probably grow over time as, you know, we're able to go to an asteroid for 1/100 the cost of what a traditional mission would be. It seems like a good side bet for NASA to place in doing that. I wouldn't say that we are in any way dependent on it, though. And that's some of what gave me the confidence of starting this business, is it actually exists on its own fundamentals. And it doesn't depend on, you know, like a large aerospace contractor would, a single large customer. And that's what really makes this the industrial age of space, in that the private demand is actually greater than the government demand right now. And this is a good sign that we're at a turning point.
How can the average person get involved? I think that's really an interesting question. And it's actually a question a lot of people have about a lot of things that are happening in this rapidly transforming age of technology that you're describing. In your particular area, is there a way that the average person can or should be getting involved?
Well, certainly go to our website, planetaryresources.com, sign up to the email list. We share news and write up things on events frequently. We're on all the normal social media things. We occasionally do things where we engage, you know, narrow or broad audiences, like the Grand Challenge that we worked with NASA for solving these asteroid problems, which involved a programming community. We have more than a dozen jobs on our website for people who may want to apply. If you do happen to know how to navigate to an asteroid and have that experience, or you are really coming of age as a recently educated engineer with no preconceived notion on the right way to do things. It's going to take new thinking to solve these problems, like Einstein. Our problems can't be solved with the same level of thinking that created them. So in a lot of ways, our future lies in our youth in that way. But in a lot of ways, I recognize how space is really a part of your lives, and it is becoming indistinct from any other facet, whether it is the autonomous technology that in your microwave that cooks the food just right on the sensor, or if it's your lane controlling capability on your car. Some of that stuff was born out of a pursuit for space. Some of that stuff actually may be converted into a pursuit for space, and it's actually all connected. And I think what really excites me every day about what we're doing is having the opportunity, in the next 10, 20 years, for space to be a place not just for astronauts, not just for billionaire space tourists, but for a place where more and more people live and work and play.
Well, we'll look forward to having you back in a couple of years and getting a progress report and seeing how it's all going. Chris Lewicki, thanks for being with us tonight. Please join me in thanking Chris.
That was Planetary Resources CEO Chris Lewicki. Next episode, you'll hear from California Endowment Senior Vice President Dr. Anthony Eitan about why your zip code may matter more to your health than your genetic code.
We haven't found a city in the United States yet that doesn't have a significant life expectancy difference from neighborhood to neighborhood.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of CHM Live Radio. This podcast is produced by Lauren Miyamoto and me, Chanel Lauren. John Plute composed our intro music, and transitional music is provided by Lee Rosevere. You can learn more about our events and the museum at computerhistory.org.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.